Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Who is the greatest African Premier League player of all time? See if your choice made our list on Match of the Day Africa Top 10, a new podcast from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Andrew Peach, and at 14 hours GMT on Friday the 21st of July, these are our main stories. The American singer Tony Bennett has died. He was 96. Frank Sinatra said he was the best in the business. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky dismisses his ambassador to Britain. And President Putin says Ukraine's counteroffensive against Russian forces has had no results. Also in this podcast, India bans exports of white rice after heavy monsoon rains damaged crops. How a village in southern Italy is being held up to the world as an example of how to successfully integrate refugees and migrants into the community. And
I cheered out loud and then I cried because it was such a breathtaking scene and because I immediately recognised the magnitude of the finding.
An unexpected discovery in an underwater volcano in the Pacific. He's been called the champion of the great American songbook, a crooner who gave life to the best love standards of the last century. Tony Bennett, the singer that even Frank Sinatra said he envied, has died at the age of 96. This was his signature song.
I left my heart in San Francisco.
Just one of countless hits in a career lasting more than 70 years. He performed with Count Basie and Lady Gaga. He appeared on The Ed Sullivan Show and MTV. Musical tastes changed. Rock replaced jazz. Crooners fell out of fashion. But Tony Bennett's popularity and his place in popular culture spans generations. Steve Jensen looks back at his life.
Smile, though your heart is aching.
He was described as the best in the business by no less than Frank Sinatra. Anthony Benedetto grew up in New York and earned a living as a singing waiter before Bob Hope encouraged him to change his name to Tony Bennett and gave him his big break. A master of the classic American song, he was also something of a heartthrob. Hundreds of women wore black the day he got married. His music developed through the 50s as he collaborated with some of the biggest names in jazz.
Chicago, the town that Marty Faye could not shut down.
He was also a talented painter and politically committed, a supporter of the civil rights movement. But gradually, the lounge suits and jazz standards slipped out of fashion. By the end of the 70s, he was divorced, taking drugs, and the work was drying up. He turned it around, not by changing his style, but by moving on from Las Vegas and seeking a new audience. He appeared on MTV and played the Glastonbury Festival. And he recorded with a string of younger stars, most famously Lady Gaga.
Oh, it don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing.
He was once again cool, working and winning awards, even in his 80s and 90s. But through it all, he always acknowledged his debt to one particular song.
I left my heart in San Francisco.
The unmistakable voice of Tony Bennett, who's died. The UK has been one of Ukraine's closest allies since the start of the Russian invasion, contributing nearly $6 billion in military aid. The two countries even cemented this relationship with a declaration of unity earlier this year. But President Volodymyr Zelensky has sacked his ambassador to London with no official explanation. I spoke to our Europe regional editor, Danny Eberhardt, to find out more.
Well, we can surmise, Andrew, that this goes back to the NATO summit that was held in Vilnius about 10 days ago. In the run-up to that summit, President Zelensky expressed frustration that there wasn't a clear timetable being set out either to invite Ukraine to join or for its actual membership. And this was put to Ben Wallace and Britain's Defence Secretary. And he said that basically he advised Ukraine effectively to show more gratitude to Western allies for military support, made a comment that, you know, Britain, for example, wasn't an Amazon delivery service when it came to weapons. And this was put to President Zelensky by a journalist, and he said he was puzzled by it. He said he didn't know how to show more gratitude, and he said, how could we do this? He offered, in his words, to wake up in the morning and thank the minister personally. Now, subsequently, this was put to the ambassador, and the ambassador criticised the president. He said that President Zelensky had used a little bit of sarcasm and that he didn't believe that sarcasm is healthy in that situation because he didn't want to show the Russians that there was something dividing allies. That seems quite mild, actually, but generally, Andrew, it's not a good idea for your career prospects if you're an ambassador to criticise your president. Perhaps there are other things that are going on that we don't know about, but that looks the most likely reason at this stage.
Ben Wallace is a senior politician in the UK government, coming to the end of his time, though, as a cabinet minister and as a member of parliament. It seems odd that he's falling out with Ukraine when Britain's prime ministers are so close to President Zelensky.
Well, he wasn't really falling out, and he sought subsequently to clarify his remarks that he said had been rather misinterpreted. He said he was saying that basically what Ukraine needed to be aware of was that not all nations are as supportive as the UK of Ukraine's military effort, and that it needs to be conscious to reach out to politicians and parliamentarians in other countries who are perhaps wavering a little bit more. So the support that Britain and other allies offers is concrete and long-lasting. But there's a battle for public opinion. President Zelensky himself has constantly stressed he's grateful to allies for military equipment and does this regularly in speeches to parliaments around the world.
Meanwhile, a couple of hours ago, some pretty punchy stuff from the Russian President Vladimir Putin, trying to suggest that Ukraine is getting nowhere despite all the backing it has from the UK and its other Western allies.
The whole world can see that the supposedly impregnable military equipment that the West boasted about is on fire, and by its tactical technical data, they can see it is often even inferior to some Soviet-made weapons. Yes, of course, additional Western armaments can be supplied and thrown into battle. This, of course, causes us certain damage and prolongs the conflict.
Yeah, this was in comments to his Security Council, televised comments. What President Putin appears to be doing is two things. One, he seems to be picking up on arguments to exacerbate any divisions in allies. Allies on the governmental level, barring a few that are a bit more equivocal, such as Hungary, are very supportive of Ukraine. There are some debates in some countries about public opinion in, for example, places like Italy and the US. So President Putin is seeking to accentuate these divisions. He's also, of course, appealing to his own domestic audience to say, these are the arguments why we have this war. He put it all on Western allies trying to tailor a war for their own interests, in particular the US, and he also had a strong go at Poland, presenting a whole series of rather warped historical arguments as to why Poland might be interested in the conflict in the first place.
Danny Eberhard reporting. Meanwhile, Russia has struck the southern Ukrainian region of Odessa with cruise missiles for the fourth night in a row. The authorities say grain facilities were once again hit. Prices of wheat had already risen sharply on global markets after Russia pulled out of a UN deal to ensure safe passage of grain shipments across the Black Sea last week. There are now further fears of food inflation, with India banning exports of some types of rice. The government took that decision regarding non-basmati white rice after heavy monsoon rains damaged crops, causing prices to rise in India by 3% in a month. Nikhil Inamdar is our India business correspondent and is in Mumbai.
Well, the impact of this could be substantial because India is the world's largest exporter of rice. About 40% of global supplies come from here. And so this decision will mean that global prices will evidently rise. And all of this is happening at a time when the export prices of Indian rice have already hit five-year highs last week. It could, however, help cool domestic prices ahead of the general elections next year. But for the rest of the world, this is particularly worrisome at a time when El Nino or hot weather patterns are expected to lead to crop damages, and a late start to the rainy season in India have stoked fears of a production shortfall. India's decision also comes in the backdrop of Russia quitting the Black Sea Grain Initiative, which has already raised concerns around global food supplies. The ban follows a move by Vietnam, the world's third largest exporter of rice, to cut exports by nearly a half to ensure domestic food security, among other things.
Nicole Inamdar in Mumbai. Lebanon's central bank governor Riyad Salameh is about to step down this month after 30 years in office. He leaves behind a country in the grip of one of the worst financial crises anywhere in the world, with more than three quarters of the population living in poverty. Many blame the country's ruling elite for massive corruption. France and Germany have issued an international arrest warrant against Salameh for illicit enrichment and embezzlement of over $300 million. Our Middle East correspondent Anna Foster reports from Beirut.
Omar Awar holds up a bottle of acid to the camera. His message is clear. He's holding up a bank to get his own money back. I just want what is rightfully mine, he says in the video, which quickly went viral. Like people across Lebanon, Omar's savings are locked in the bank, worth just a fraction of their real value. He leaves with his cash to pay for the next surgery doctors say he urgently needs. Without it, he could be left paralysed. When we met a few days later, he described what happened.
I spilled some drops on a calculator and on the floor to show the acid was for real. It bubbled and boiled. And I said, no transaction will happen to any customer before I retrieve my deposit.
What about the people who work in the bank? This isn't their fault, and that must have been a really frightening moment for them.
They are like my sisters and brothers, and I'll apologize to them now. I never intended to harm any of them, but I also wish for them to understand my situation and where I'm coming from.
Omar isn't the first in Lebanon to hold up a bank to withdraw his savings. Over the last year, it's become an increasingly regular occurrence. Those who do it say it's because they're desperate. Since the financial crisis began here, people's money has been hugely devalued and hard to access. UNICEF says nearly 9 in 10 households can't now afford basic essentials. The concrete walls outside the central bank here that are topped with barbed wire that are designed to protect this building have been daubed with black and red paint. There are obscenities scrawled across here, the result of protests, not just at the central bank, but all around this part of Beirut, where the main banks are based. Many of them now have metal shutters, physically separating them from the outside world. Lebanon's economy is in a dire state. Its currency has lost 98% of its value. Some of the blame for that has been levelled at its long-standing governor, Riyad Salameh. He's also been accused of running a huge Ponzi scheme, borrowing new money to pay existing creditors until the economy started to collapse. As he prepares to stand down after 30 years, he's being investigated by at least seven countries, including Lebanon, for embezzlement and illicit enrichment. It's claimed he laundered more than $300 million. Zino Hakim is the president of Swiss NGO Accountability Now. They've been researching Riyad Salameh for several years and have filed criminal complaints against him in multiple countries.
To have a governor of a central bank being suspected by European prosecutors of belonging to a criminal organization, that's a first.
When we sat down for a rare interview at the central bank, I asked Riyad Salameh about those accusations.
I deny all these suspicions.
Why didn't you go to be questioned when you were called? Because if you're being transparent and if there's no weight to these allegations, don't you fully cooperate with the investigation?
I am attending all the interrogation that I have to attend in Lebanon. First, let us decide if there is a crime in Lebanon. And then this crime will have repercussions in the country where I invested money.
Are you going to France to be questioned?
When I am duly notified, I will go to France. Please give us a date for us to come.
Whether Mr. Salameh will ever appear for questioning in France remains to be seen, but his departure from the top job won't mark an end to Lebanon's economic crisis. In downtown Beirut, depositors are still regularly protesting to try and get their precious savings back. But with no clear successor to Riyad Salameh, and no solution in sight,
public anger towards the banks will only keep growing.
Anna Foster reporting. Now to an extraordinary discovery 1.5 kilometres below the Pacific Ocean off the coast of Canada. Scientists have found an enormous white skatefish nursery on top of an ancient underwater and active volcano. The volcano was thought to be extinct and the waters around it cold. Previous discoveries of Pacific skate eggs amounted to just a few dozen, making this skate egg nursery important for the ecosystem of the ocean. Dr. Charisse Duperez is a deep sea marine biologist with Fisheries and Oceans Canada and the principal investigator on the expedition. She spoke to Victoria Uwankunda from a vessel in the Pacific.
While it's unusual to find a volcano under the water that is venting hot fluid, what is most remarkable about it is that there was a deep sea skate nursery on this volcano. So we saw shimmering warm water flowing out of the volcano, and it was bathing hundreds of thousands of skate eggs. To top it all off, there were actually large female skates flying over, ready to lay more eggs. And it was just an incredible, you know, mesmerizing symphony of life that we got to witness.
What do they look like?
The skate species I'm speaking about is the Pacific white deep sea skate. It's about 2 meters large. A lot of people might be familiar with manta rays. A skate is a close member of the shark family. They're larger, they have expansive wings, and they very much fly through the ocean. Even though it's very, very cute looking, it is a predator of the deep sea, and so it plays a very important role at the top of the food chain in the deep sea. And it lays eggs on the seafloor, very large eggs, 30 centimeters across. And in the past, you know, if we find one or two here, there, maybe a couple dozen, it's a big find. We estimate that there's something close to a million, anywhere up to 5 million on top of this volcano. As a professional scientist, I cheered out loud and then I cried because it was such a breathtaking scene and because I immediately recognized the magnitude of the finding.
In this place where they were found, where you found this volcano underwater, is it protected? If not, should it be protected?
The volcano is not protected. And it is unnerving to imagine the harm that would be caused to this beautiful place, this important place, by bottom contact fishing, by something like deep sea mining, what it would mean for the large skate population if something like the magnitude of this nursery was harmed. But the reason that we were there is because Canada and Canada's Indigenous First Nations recognize seamounts, these underwater volcanoes and vents, as places to protect. And we have so far protected almost every seamount and hydrothermal vent in Canada. And it's my job to explore the deep and to provide the science advice for the conservation and the management. So hopefully, by identifying this site as the one-of-a-kind habitat that it is, and talking about its essential ecosystem functions and its importance to the sustainable health of the ocean, hopefully it will not be very long until this joins the list of protected volcanoes in our waters.
Dr. Charisse Duperez. Still to come in this podcast, Australian police investigate the death of a teenager decades ago.
If he was a white boy, we certainly wouldn't be here today.
And, you know, we need to know what's happened, who was involved.
It was foul play.
Match of the Day Africa Top 10 is the new podcast from the BBC World Service discussing all things African football. Join me, Gabriel Zakwani, and two players who know a thing or two about competing on the international stage.
Hi, Yaya Touré here.
And Efan Ekoku.
As we try to choose a winner in our African football top 10s, from the best African defenders to the greatest World Cup moments. That's Match of the Day Africa Top 10. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
The number of people making the risky crossing of the Mediterranean Sea to reach Europe has increased considerably this year, and it is risky. In some incidents, hundreds of people are believed to have drowned. Still, people continue to do it, though. It's a hot political issue, not least in Italy, where a new, more right-wing government wants to make migration harder. So what's life like for refugees and migrants in Italy now? James Cottnell has spent some time in a small southern Italian village, Camini, which is held up as an example of successful integration.
Go, brother.
A cluster of kids are gathered around a table football game. Behind them, green hills tumble down to the coast, the sea glinting in the distance. This is a beautiful place. We're sitting in a cafe here, and the Syrian music on the radio is the first sign that something out of the ordinary is happening.
Couscous e polipo, però è un po' piccante.
Couscous and octopus, it's a bit spicy.
Yes.
We're eating a sumptuous meal cooked by Italian and Libyan chefs. In this small village, almost one person out of three is a refugee or a migrant.
Benvenuti a Camini, siamo...
You're welcome here in Camini. You're welcome to our project. In 2011, this town is reborn.
A town reborn, they say, thanks to a long-standing initiative to welcome in migrants and refugees. It's known as Yunji Mundu, or Unite the World, in the local dialect. Newcomers to Camini learn Italian and work in the cafe or in several other projects dotted around the town. Zakaria, who is translating and showing us around, fled the war in Syria.
People who are coming here, they're not coming here only to do nothing. They left their life. They want to start a new life because of many reasons, mostly because of the war. Those people, they need help, of course, a new country, new language, new culture. But here, the project plus the hospitality of the people who are living here, this helps so much. For me, I think it's the healthiest environment for migrants to come. They don't think they're only numbers or they're refugees. They feel included in the community. This is so important.
Mi chiamo Pino Alfarano.
His name is Pino Alfarano. He's the mayor of this small village, Camini.
So Camini has changed a lot in the last 10 years or so.
Sì, assolutamente sì, perché...
At the beginning of the project, the welcoming project, the school was closed, so just one class was open. Now, after 10 years, there are all the schools open with the multicultural class, with children from all over the world, also children from Camini. They opened the postal office with the ATM, the bank, so they create new economy, and they are very proud because they build a project to welcoming people flee from the war. So they are very proud to this new community of Camini.
In one of the projects here, derelict old houses are painstakingly restored. Hassan and Cosmano, a foreigner and a local, work companionably under the searing sun, laying bricks and cementing their own friendship.
My name is Hassan. I'm from Senegal. I came here in 2014, 18 July.
Oh, you remember the day, the exact day?
No, I remember.
And how do people react to you? I guess they're used to seeing foreigners and refugees and migrants here, but when they see you in the streets of Camini, how do they react to you?
No, me and them like brothers. Mm-hmm. All of them. They're my friends. I have friends, for example. I have sisters. I have dads and moms. Yeah.
An Italian family here?
Yeah, of course. Mm. And Cosmano is my family.
Cosmano Fonte.
My name is Cosmano Fonte.
Have you learnt any words of other languages with all these people living here?
Sicuramente non erano gli anni giusti. In all those 12 years, it wasn't possible for me to learn, of course, with all the work he's doing. But the thing that I've learned in all those years is humanity.
James Cottnell in southern Italy. It's been 35 years since the Aboriginal teenager Mark Haines was found dead on railway tracks in Australia. But now a podcast has sparked police to reopen the case with a reward of $1 million Australian for any information that helps them to solve it. Back in 1988, detectives concluded that Mark had laid on the tracks on purpose or in a dazed state after a night out. His family have long refuted this and contributed to ABC's Blood on the Tracks podcast, which shed new light on the case.
This is unbelievable. We can't believe this. And we couldn't, to this day, believe that he went out there of his own volition.
Yeah, I think that obviously if he was a white boy, we certainly wouldn't be here today.
And, you know, we need to know what's happened, who was involved.
It was foul play.
From Sydney, our correspondent Phil Mercer told me more about the podcast.
Well, it provided a breakthrough in 2018, which would have been the 30th anniversary of the death of Mark Haines. And in 2018, the police reopened their investigation, prompting some significant progress. Back at the time, his family insisted that Mark Haines' death wasn't taken seriously because he was Aboriginal. Now, we've had two coronial inquests. They have both found that a crime had been committed, but otherwise they were inconclusive. So what we've had today is the New South Wales state government doubling and previous reward of $500,000 Australian. So now $1 million Australian, that's the equivalent of around $678,000 US, is on offer. And the police and Mark Haines's relatives are hoping that this reward will finally provide a vital breakthrough in this very long case.
And what makes this particularly powerful, as you said, is the suggestion of racism, the suggestion that this wasn't investigated properly at the time because Mark wasn't white, because he was from the Aboriginal community.
Yes, this is a death that occurred in January 1988 near the town of Tamworth in New South Wales. This is about 400 kilometres north of Sydney. And Australia back in the late 1980s was a very different country, quite clearly, to the one it is today in terms of its multicultural makeup and its attitudes to Indigenous people. But back then, his family was suggesting that the death wasn't taken seriously because he was Aboriginal. But we get the sense, hearing from Mark Haines's family, that they believe that this reward could provide a significant breakthrough. They are warning anyone in the community with information to come forward before the police come knocking at their door. And quite clearly, over time, allegiances and friendships change. And this huge reward, it's hoped not only by the family, but from the authorities as well, are hoping that this could well provide the information that this case has been waiting for 35 years.
I was going to say, I mean, it wouldn't seem likely that any case so old would be easily solved at this point, but there seems to be genuine optimism that this one might be.
Yes, and much of that goes down to the Australian Broadcasting Corporation's podcast, Blood on the Tracks. We've had a couple of other very high-profile cases in this country that have been reignited by podcasts. Last year, homicide detectives handed a report to the coroner. So they are hoping, both the police and the family, that a breakthrough is only around the corner.
Phil Mercer in Sydney. We've heard a lot about the heatwave in Europe, but wide swathes of the US are also experiencing extreme heat. Phoenix in Arizona, for example, has seen temperatures above 40 Celsius for 3 weeks now. Heat alerts have been issued in more than a dozen states. And as if that wasn't enough, in North Carolina, people are cleaning up after a tornado destroyed homes this week. Astrid Martinez from CBS News told me more from New York.
The nation feels like this is something that's unfamiliar and the temperatures are extreme. It doesn't mean that the people who live in Phoenix like it any better, especially when the temperatures are so high and for so many days in a row. Now, they're expected to be hitting a 22nd consecutive day above 110 degrees or 43.3 degrees Celsius. And that's a new record. This is a level of heat that we are having in Phoenix right now is enormously dangerous, particularly for people who either don't have air conditioning or cannot afford to operate it for so many days at a high temperature. And Phoenix is also experiencing high levels of homelessness, and it's very difficult to find shelter for so many people under such extreme heat. Andrew?
There's also been a lot of focus in recent days on California. Where else in the States is experiencing unusually high temperatures that are causing problems for people?
Well, the record-setting heat that we're experiencing is across the south, and it's going to be intensifying and expanding through the weekend. And the southwest, we're seeing Arizona, Las Vegas, also Miami and parts of Florida. Just last week, Miami, for the first time, issued its first ever high excessive heat warning, and they're going to be experiencing high temperatures again today. And the unrelenting heat wave is going to continue for lots of parts of the southwest for its eighth week in a row.
Astrid Martinez in New York. Now, an update on a story we featured on Thursday's podcasts. Police in India say a group of women in Manipur have attacked the house of the main suspect in a sexual assault case that sparked widespread anger. This as the authorities arrested four men after a video emerged showing two abducted women being paraded naked and assaulted by a mob. Here's Lipika Pelham.
A senior police officer in the state capital, Imphal, said local women shouted angrily, pelted stones while using long sticks to damage the walls of the house of the primary suspect, who was identified from the video clip. The women then set fire to it. This came as the authorities arrested four men after the footage went viral, showing two abducted women from the minority Christian Kuki community being paraded naked and assaulted by a mob. In the video, a man believed to be the primary suspect is seen wearing a green T-shirt dragging one of the women. The incident happened in May during an outbreak of communal violence.
Lipika Pelham reporting. Now, did you know only humans and a few whale species go through the menopause? One of those is the orca. And new research has revealed that postmenopausal female orcas protect their sons, but not their daughters, from fights with other males. Charlie Grimes is an animal behaviourist at the University of Exeter in England and the lead researcher of this study.
Socially inflicted injuries were only reduced for males, so for sons, when their post-reproductive mother was present, which is really cool to see that we didn't find the same effect in females. Mm-hmm. And I guess the most striking thing was that just how targeted that support was. So we found that if you have a post-reproductive female in your social unit and she's not your mother, your injuries aren't reduced, and so there's no benefit to having her around. So it mm-hmm. isn't that these females are policing the behavior of the group as a whole. They're not moderating conflict as a whole, but the mothers are really, you know, directing this protective kind of support towards their sons. So yeah, that was really interesting.
Charlie Grimes. Our science correspondent Victoria Gill has more.
Male orcas stick close to their mum's side well into adulthood. And long after they've stopped having new calves, older female killer whales play a vital role in their family group, particularly in protecting their male offspring. The scientists combed through thousands of photographs of orcas looking for tooth rake marks on their bodies, telltale signs that a killer whale's been in a fight. Studying the animal's battle scars revealed that when a male was with his postmenopausal mum, he had fewer injuries. Males that weren't with their mums or that had mothers that were still reproducing had more tooth rake marks, and daughters didn't benefit from this maternal protection at all. The research is part of an ongoing mission to understand why female killer whales, like female humans, stop reproducing partway through their lifespan. Older mothers will protect and even feed 5-ton adult sons so that they can pass on their genes to the next generation.
Our science correspondent, Victoria Gill. And that's all from us for now, but before we go, here's Jackie with news of the next edition of The Happy Pot.
Yes, in the next edition, what's being described as a turning point in the treatment of Alzheimer's disease. We've got the men who've managed to remake trees so that paper and other such products become cleaner and greener. The Indian midwife who safely delivered more than 10,000 babies. From Iceland and the UK, repaying a kindness across generations. And solving a maths puzzle that has baffled some very clever people for over 50 years. All in the Happy Pod, available from Saturday, the 22nd of July.
If you'd like to comment on this podcast and the stories we included, drop us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk or on Twitter. We are at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Robin Schroeder. The producer was Marion Strawn. The editor is Karen Martin. My name is Andrew Peach. Thanks for listening. Until next time, goodbye.
Thank you.